The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from a Blue Cliff Record collection of koans. Case 35, the dialogue of Manjushri and Wucho, the pointer. Determining dragons and snakes, distinguishing jewels and stones, separating the profound and the naive, to settle all uncertainty. If you haven't an eye on your forehead and a talisman under your elbow, time and again you'll miss the point immediately. Right at this very moment, seeing and hearing are not obscured. Sound and form are purely real. Tell me, is it black? Is it white? Is it crooked? Is it straight? At this point, how will you discriminate? Main case. Manjushri asked Wucho, where have you come from? Wucho said, from the south. Manjushri said, how is the Buddhist teaching being carried on in the south? Wucho said, monastics of the last age have little regard for the rules of discipline. Manjushri said, how numerous are the congregations? Wucho said, some 300, some 500. Then Wucho asked Manjushri, how's it being carried on hereabouts? Manjushri said, ordinary people and sages dwell together. Dragons and snakes intermingle. Wucho said, how numerous are the congregations? Manjushri said, in front, 3x3, in back, 3x3. The verse. The thousand peaks twist and turn, the color of indigo. Who says Manjushri was conversing with him? It's laughable how many the people on Qingliang. In front, 3x3, and in back, 3x3. So good morning. And as those of you at home might have surmised, we woke up this morning with one and then several more residents testing positive for COVID. And so we had been in the midst of an introductory retreat this weekend. And so many of those folks who were here for the weekend, unfortunately, chose or were encouraged to go ahead and head home just so that they're not extending their exposure amongst those of us who might have this or be carrying it. And then there are a few stalwart, temporarily stranded of you who are waiting for a bus later, so are able to stay with us, which is good. So I thought this would be a good koan to do at the beginning of the Ango, because as those of you who are studying the moon fascicle of Master Dogen's know that this is how he opens up his teaching. So we are in Ango, an intensive training period, and we're studying this teaching by this 13th century master Dogen, who wrote a teaching called The Moon, which begins, fully actualizing moons is not limited to before 3-3 or after 3-3. Moons fully actualized are not limited to before 3-3 or after 3-3. And so this sort of strange reference that Master Dogen invokes, that I think certainly came from this koan, because Dogen was very familiar with the koans of the Rinzai tradition, the Linji tradition, and would have known about this for sure. And so in the pointer, it says, determining dragons and snakes, distinguishing jewels and stones. And so as we know, we do perceive differences. We see things and see them as distinguished or distinct from the next. Trees from bridges, high from low, light from dark, good from bad. Our senses perceive these different characteristics so that we can navigate our world and relate to things knowingly. The mind or our senses simply perceive, as it says in the pointer says, right at this very moment, your seeing and hearing are not obscured. So then in the first moment of contact, what we see, what we hear is not obscured. Sound and form are purely real. They are just as they are. They're not anything other. But our mind, in an instant, before we know it, without our seeing it, floods that image or that sound or that taste or that touch with all of our mind's karmic burden. All of our associations, our experiences, our beliefs, our views, our memories, and so on. And so while our senses simply perceive things not obscured, our mind then begins to, in an instant, in a flash, obscure and bring with it something that is very, very powerful, which is meaning. And we of course, need to be taught what things mean. We don't just come into this world with that. And so all of the people around us, our family and friends, our school, our institutions, media, everything in society teaches us what those things that we see mean. And in that, the world of inclusion and exclusion, of belonging and not belonging, of superior and inferior, worthy and unworthy, all of those ways that we separate and distinguish and exclude and include and create conflict and wealth and poverty, as the Buddha might say, the whole mass of suffering. Dragons in the Zen tradition usually refer to enlightened beings. Snakes, not so. Snakes have a rough time in the human world. We lay a lot on them. So snakes are considered to be more of deluded beings. But in this, in Buddhism, although they sort of are given that role, if you will, which is so we can reflect on those aspects within ourselves, it's not about dragons, it's not about snakes, they're fine. But even in pointing to or giving that kind of meaning to those creatures, what we are ultimately, the point of that is ultimately realize that dragons are not above, snakes are not below. One is not superior to the other. There is enlightenment and delusion, but they are not you. They are not the self. And so, as he says in the pointer, to be able to separate the profound from the naive, to distinguish a jewel from a stone, is actually necessary. We need to be able to discern. If we can't discern within our own practice of what is practice according with the Dharma and what's not, what is just a self-serving or a habitual desire, and what is an impulse or a sense of a direction that we can trust, it's going to be very difficult to practice. So we need to learn how to distinguish, but to do so from without malice, without ill will towards what we're distinguishing, with clarity, and without infusing a sense of absolute truth into those things that we are discerning. Dogen said, to study the way is to study the self. We seek happiness, contentment, fulfillment. We want to be at ease. We want to have a reasonable opportunity to pursue our lives in the way that we think that we are drawn to have a meaningful life, meaningful relationships, meaningful work, that is gratifying, that is satisfying, that is offering, that is more than just about ourselves. And within all of that, everything is impermanent. As the Buddha said, everything that is dear to you will pass. Is passing. And so we develop different strategies to deal with or not to deal with that. So one strategy is aversion. We basically deny, we reject, we try and exclude or push away. And the thing is once we develop a strategy that we try to apply selectively, we fail, right? Because the mind in the world is not so easily divided into discrete, solid boundaries. And so when we try to deny those things that are difficult or unpleasant, we end up denying much more than that. We can end up denying in ways that we might not even recognize, life itself, our own happiness. And that can take the form of irrational anger, irrational hatred. That is rational in the sense of, I can explain why this is justified, why this needs to be so, why you deserve to be the object of my anger. It can develop a cynicism and indifference. Right? Human consciousness has a whole array of subtle ways in which we can dwell within that family of aversion. On the other side, we can develop a strategy of attaching, of grasping, of running after things, trying to hold on, solidify. Generally, we live in both camps. We get pretty adept at doing both, and we just swing back and forth. And so how within that can we be at peace in this life, not the one that we were supposed to be having, not in the time that we would prefer to be living in, and not amongst the people that we would do much better if we were with? In other words, if we want to change the course of a human life like yours and mine, and maybe in a larger sense, more lives, to interrupt that long-standing tradition of destruction and excessiveness, something will need to turn. The Buddha said, Dogen said, if we do not step forward, we will never encounter the Dharma. If we do not learn how to bend, then we will continue to cycle, go through those cycles. And so here in this kind of magical koan, Wuzhou was visiting Mount Wutai in China, a sacred mountain, a mountain where Manjushri, a non-historical bodhisattva of wisdom, lived. And he came to a place, Wuzhou came to a place that was rough and wild. And so Manjushri produced a temple for Wuzhou to stay in overnight and then appeared. And so they had this conversation where Manjushri said, where have you come from? Wuzhou said, I'm from down south. How's the Buddhist teaching going on down there? Not so good. Monks have little regard for the Dharma, for the rules of practice, and so on. How large are the sanghas? Some 300, some 500. And then Wuzhou said, how about here? How's it being carried on here? And Manjushri said, ordinary people and sages are dwelling together. Dragons and snakes intermingle. How large is the sangha here? Front, 3x3. In back, 3x3. Ordinary people and sages dwell together. Dragons and snakes. The 10,000 things, the whole universe, all of humanity, all of creation, sharing this one great Earth Mother, all relying on the Earth itself and all of us, actually, to make it work. So, why in the human realm is it so difficult? Why, with all of our imagination and our creativity and our intelligence and our ability to invent, to create things that have never existed, to conceive, to envision an idea of how we might live, to have received to have inherited all of these religious teachings from different traditions, which, though different, all understand certain things to be basic truths. The golden rule, and how that is expressed and understood in virtually every tradition. And we hear that and we nod and agree and say, yes, yes, I agree, I'm all for it, let's do that. But it's not so easy. So the Buddha realized, wanted to know why. Why is it not so easy? What's the hang up here? How are we getting hung up in this? Every other life form seems to have found its own way and its way amidst its own congregation. So what's up with us anyway? And so the Buddha said, we have to go to the root. We can't just turn the light around. We can't just look inward. It's nice to say, well, the answer lies within. Hooray. What does that mean? Right? Where exactly? How will I know when I find it? How do I get there? And so someone had to actually do that, to take it out of the realm of the theoretical or the aspirational or the magical thinking, and actually investigate, examine directly, is there a way? Is there something, a truth, an experience, a reality that actually exists within us that shows us, reveals to us that which perhaps we all have a sense is. There is a way, there has to be a way to live freely. And that we call the Buddha's enlightenment. What did the Buddha see? In the moon, Fasgul Dogen says, Buddha's true Dharma body, the body of reality, the body of the Buddha, the body of awakening, the body that is not the personal body, not your karmic body, it's not the body that was given a name, but it's not separate from that either. The Buddha's true Dharma body, as it is, seen and heard without obscuration, purely real, is open sky. That's its nature. The Buddha's true Dharma body is the as it is of open sky. And this as it is, this open sky, this Dharma body, your body and mine, your inherently or fundamentally enlightened nature, is the entire earth, it's the entire universe, it's every phenomenal thing in this world, it's every appearance. They are all, we are all, it is all open sky. Hundreds of grasses, myriad forms, each appearing as it is, unobscured, purely real. This is what we call the Buddha's true Dharma body. And all of this, the Buddha realized, is dwelling together, intermingling, without hindrance. And so what that is telling us is that every disturbance, every conflict, every rupture is not something that exists as it is. In other words, it's not something that just exists in the world by itself, but is created. What the Buddha realized, because it is uniquely and singularly, we might say, within the human realm, or if that's not true somehow, if families of creatures have their own deluded realms, shall we let them work that out? We have our own work to do. So within the human world, what the Buddha realized is that it ultimately is the self that clings to itself, desiring for itself, and that sets it apart. And being set apart, that sense of distance, of apartness, of estrangement, of fracture, of rupture, which is not true, it's not the true reality of what is happening, but it is our experience, a sense of isolation appears. That's the fracture. That's the break. That's the trying to get back to the garden. That's the seemingly almost universal sense that we are trying to return, trying to reunify, trying to get back to something that is like our home. But not being there or perceiving that we're not there, we get a little anxious or very anxious. And then that begins to drive much. One of the women ancestors that we chanted this morning and chant every day, Mugai Nyodai, was a 13th century, as eventually a nun and a teacher. She was born at the time of Dogen. Dogen was, I think, about 23 when she was born. Born into a wealthy family, a samurai family, very well educated, classic arts, poetry, music, even the use of a long sword blade. At an early age, she learned to read and speak Chinese. She learned about management and finances. Married, raised a daughter, and in her 40s, she began to visit Rinzai Linji monasteries. She became interested in Zen. And when she was 44, her husband died. And she was supposed to, sort of culturally expected, to go back and take care of her father. But she didn't do that. She was getting more and more drawn towards Buddha Dharma. And so she began going to a particular monastery where there was a particular teacher that she had heard speak and was drawing her in. And she went to him and said, "What is Zen?" And he said, "Zen is the heart of the one who asks. It's not someone else's words." And at that, she began to visit regularly and practice. And then one day, she showed up in her kimono. And her teacher knew what that meant, so he shaved her head and ordained her. And that began her monastic training. And one of her jobs was to bring water back and forth from the temple, from the river to the temple. And one day, the bottom of the bucket broke and fell out. And she wrote this enlightenment poem. "So many ways I fixed the bucket. Its brace is weak and soon to break. Until one day the bottom fell out. Then there was no water in the bucket and no moon shining in the water." And the bucket is often used as an image, often is referred to as a black lacquered bottom bucket. That when you look in is utterly dark, right? Is a way of looking into that which is beyond all of the activity, the hustle and bustle, the discrimination, the distance, the separation of all experience, and seeing into the nature of the absolute. And when that bottom of the bucket breaks, that's usually refers to when everything falls out, collapses, when there is a kind of spiritual death and we realize the self. So it's kind of interesting. I'm assuming that her bucket bottom actually broke. It doesn't really matter. It's a wonderful poem. She went on to study and continue her study, receive transmission, and went on to be a teacher in her own right. She founded her own temple, which was the first training monastery for women in Japan. And she was very well known. She suffered a stroke later in her life and continued to teach, even though she was suffered from that. "So many ways I fixed the bucket. Its brace is weak and soon to break." Having that sense of isolation, of distance, of separateness, of anxiety, of dis-ease, what do we do? Well, in so many ways, we can try and fix it, right? Shore it up, cover it over, explain it away, stay ahead of it, pretend it's not there, distract ourselves, just turn the music up a little louder, appropriate it and dress it up and say that it's something wonderful. But all the while wanting intimacy, aliveness, connection, belonging, peace, those things that we rightly yearn for. And so in Buddhism, there is the raising of bodhicitta, the raising of the bodhi mind, the mind that seeks, that isn't just aware of, just developing strategies for, or complacent to, or angry about that sense of dis-ease, but actually decides to respond and seeks. We seek a teacher, we seek teachings, we seek a practice. What is a way? Is there a way? What do I need to do? What can I do? When we realize no one is actually going to come and do this for us. And if we find our way to a Sangha, even before then, but finding our way to a Sangha, we have found our way to a place where ordinary people and sages dwell together, where dragons and snakes intermingle. It's a very appropriate description of a Sangha. But what does that mean? What is dwelling together? What does he mean by intermingling? And what does he mean when he says, how many are there in this Sangha? And Manjushri says, in front, 3x3, and back, 3x3. The footnote to that says, crazy words, insane talk. But tell me, how many are there? Even the great compassionate one, Avalokiteshvara, with 1,000 hands and eyes, cannot count them all. We can begin, and really need to begin, asking that question about these ordinary people and sages, dragons and snakes dwelling together, intermingling, by checking out those very beings within ourselves. How about that? You don't have to go anywhere. And so we begin to see the kind one and the mean one, the generous one and the stingy one, the forgiving one and the blaming one, the creating life one and the destroying life one, the diligent one and the lazy one. It goes on and on. We all have our many beings and their twins dwelling within us. How is it that they are dwelling together? How is it that they're intermingling? How do we understand it? What often happens in practice is they continue to do what they have done, which is they fight. They fight each other. I mean, think about the oldest story in the world of the fight between good and evil. Where did that story come from? Where did the seed for that story come from? And so if we want to, as the Buddha said, stop, I'm not going to quarrel with the world, although the world may quarrel with me. If I don't want myself to quarrel with me, I have to stop quarreling with it. I have to learn how to do that within the midst of the conflict, to be peace. And to do that in a way that is actually real, not an idea, not a contrived notion, right? I'm a Buddhist, I'm compassionate, so I'm going to pretend. That just doesn't work. To see, to know clearly, to practice without malice, two hands of one body, that both ultimately are empty of treasures and poisons. And that's why we need to be able to determine dragons and snakes, distinguish jewels and stones, to know and be able to recognize within us what is skillful, what is not skillful, what is going to help us, what is not helping us, what do we need to strengthen, what do we need to let drop away. You know, very often when people really begin to reflect on and practice the Buddhist precepts, the teachings of morality, which are based in selflessness, based in wanting to alleviate suffering, wanting to do good, a very common question is the recognition that comes out of the recognition of, in a moment where I'm going to act and I have a sense of what is true, what is selfless, what is actually going to be beneficial for another, how do I know if I'm reading that right? How do I know if I just don't have some sort of subtle self-interest, if this is really about me, if it's really some subtle form of manipulation? And so very often, and that's a perfectly valid question, trying to distinguish. How clear is this? My intention, my motivation, my action. And that's important because that's going to feed into that action and its consequence and is the karma, the consciousness I'm creating. And what I say is, that's your job, that's your business, is to know. But don't wait until you're 100% clear. You can't afford to wait. We can't afford for you to wait. So do your best. Do your best to be as clear as you can. And then go. And you'll see. Right? Because anything that is arising from suffering is going to create some. And if you care and if you're paying attention, you'll notice. And that is how we learn to distinguish, to discern, to be more clear. And in training, that's a lot of what training is about, is being guided, learning how to guide ourselves in this very path of dragons and snakes, ordinary people and sages, all of the inner beings, trying to come to peace within ourselves, as we are trying to, at the same time, be at peace with each other. But along the way, there are going to be some skirmishes. Just know that. Right? And so we also have to be adept at recognizing those and all of their degrees and ways they show up, and then how to take responsibility for that. And that's such a key, essential aspect of practicing Buddha Dharma, is that we get to the point in our life where we are not just willing, but we want to actually take responsibility. We want to be responsible. Which really means we recognize we always have been, but we weren't always owning up to it. And now it's time. Because until that happens, we render ourselves somewhat feeble, impotent. So that we stop trying to fix the bucket, give it a new coat of paint, right? Turn it around so you don't see the side that's got a hole in it, which is an ongoing effort, of course, takes a lot of energy. And realize that bucket is fine. However old it might be, however patched up it might be, it's fine. Even as it's leaking, it's fine. In and of itself. And so that as we practice that, being that person, responding to this mind in that faith, in that non-discriminating. So if we think of the difference between discerning differences, just recognizing, and then discriminating consciousness is where we solidify, reify those differences and set them apart, set them against each other. That's what we're trying to free ourselves of. So that all things can return to their original state and realize that all in that state, there's nothing to be done. There's nothing that is in need. There's not a thing that is missing. And that is not even a state. It's not a moment of meditation. It's not a result of your samadhi or your mental power or your aspiration. It's just in front 3x3, in back 3x3. And we see that you and I and every person and everything is just like this. Never apart, never distant, never at odds until we make it so. It's like the often asked question, still sometimes, where people are drawn to Buddhism, want to practice, and are also active in another faith tradition. And they want to know, is there a conflict in that? And I say, is there? Do you want there to be? From a Buddhist perspective, there never was. I don't know how your priest, your minister, the Pope, I don't know how they would feel about it. But from a Buddhist perspective, which means really from the perspective of reality, the way things are, there is no conflict. So we chanted this morning, if you do not see the way, you do not see it even as you're walking on it. When we walk the way, it's not near, it's not far. It's not a matter of distance. And yet, if we're deluded, if we don't see it, if it's not clear, then it's as though we're mountains and rivers away from it. And of course, that's what we experience. We can feel as though we are so far away from that which we seek. And that what the Buddha realizes is that's actually never true. And so within this world of infinite variety, infinite richness, when we stop trying to fix what is not broken, improve what is already complete, stop trying to explain what is already clear, stop trying to own what cannot be possessed, and actually get increasingly weary of trying to do all of those things, because it's tiring, actually. I mean, that's part of samsara. We've become kind of inured, we accommodate samsara that we stop really noticing, in many ways, of the great toll that it takes to keep all this going. The more we practice, the more we see, oh my God, this is really exhausting. You know, there are moments where it's like, it's exhausting to be me, right? Like, I'm tired of it. I'm weary. I would like to take that valuable, precious, powerful energy and apply it, direct it towards just living, just being. And so when we actually get tired of carrying on the same way and have enough trust and faith, then we're approaching that point where the bottom drops out. And so it is spoken of sometimes as a spiritual death, a death just to that sense of myself as existing, as a thing, something I need to protect, something I need to perform, something I need to possess. And then we realize that really from the beginning, the kid was all right all along. The meal has always been cooked. The table was always set. Everyone was invited and has been here waiting. You know, I've often had the image of, as a practitioner, we can turn around and sort of reject the Dharma. You know, I'm done with this. I'm weary of this. This isn't working. And that can last for a moment or a day or a year or 10 years or 20 years. I've seen all of that over the years. But in the moment where we turn around again, it's there. And we realize the Dharma never leaves us, right? In that sense, if we want to give a kind of personification to it, it never gives up. And that's really the heart of the Bodhisattva. In front, 3x3, in back, 3x3. How many is that? Well, as I said, start with the one that you have the most direct and intimate contact with. The Buddha said, start with the one that is dearest to you. Even the way that shows up can sometimes be turning against ourself. That was just evolved as a strategy, right? In the awareness or the subtle sense of this tear, this break, this sense of being distant from something essential. And so for those of you who are here, and we're here for the weekend, and those of you who left home, I hope you get home and are able to watch this or listen to this. Thank you for coming, for being here this weekend. I hope it was helpful. And that whatever direction you take, and I'm speaking to all of us, that I hope it is a direction and that it does continue, that we all keep taking steps forward, whether it's within Buddha Dharma, whether it's in this Sangha, or whether it's in some other path, to turn towards what we call this great matter. And so I'll end with a poem. This splendid bucket worn and tattered, with the signs of 100 years of loneliness. This ordinary bucket, reflecting the moon and myriad stars in one single body, is you.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.